As frequent and blustery in northwest Scotland, although the winds will gradually ease here. Elsewhere, the showers will come and go. There will be some sunny spells, during which temperatures will reach 7 to 9 Celsius. Finally, northeast England and eastern Scotland. A few showers are possible, but most will have a dry day with spells of sunshine. Temperatures 6 to 9 Celsius. It'll be chilly again on Saturday. Again, sunshine and showers for most places. More persistent rain perhaps in the south. A cold night on Saturday night with a touch of frost in many places. Sunday, though, should generally be dry and sunny, although there'll be a bit of rain edging into western areas later on. Temperatures generally through the weekend 8 to 11 Celsius. That's the forecast.
Thanks, Alex. Now on BBC Radio 4, our Book of the Week, Toby Jones reads a fourth extract from Olivier, Philip Ziegler's new biography of Laurence Olivier.
Sometime towards the end of 1944, the first year in which Olivier played in repertory at the resurrected Old Vic, a man came to the box office and asked for a ticket for a Laurence Olivier play. Which play? Asked the ticket seller. It doesn't matter, whatever he is in. There were a handful of other actors who could aspire to the same grandeur. One of these was Ralph Richardson, who did more than anybody else to get the revived Old Vic underway. There was precious little other than its name and reputation to help. The building itself had been badly damaged in the war, the management long disbanded. The Old Vic board invited Richardson and Tyrone Guthrie to take over the new theatre and put the show back on the road. Guthrie was also running Sadler's Wells at the time, and Richardson knew he must recruit some partners who could share the burden of the acting as well as the management. The first two men he applied to were Laurence Olivier and John Gielgud. It sounds a harebrained scheme, Olivier wrote at the time, but we feel very strongly that the theatre should have some national representation in London, particularly at this time. Gielgud was more difficult to tie down. The thought of entering a triumvirate with Olivier was unappealing. It would be a disaster, Gielgud is said to have told Richardson. You'd have to spend all your time as a referee between Larry and me. He already had his own independent company and decided it would be best to keep it going, in competition with the Old Vic. When the Old Vic went on to produce a series of triumphs, he admitted ruefully, I was a bit down. I enormously admired what they did. Richardson and Olivier, then, would provide the main driving force behind the revived Old Vic. Richardson took the leads in the first two plays before Olivier stepped up to play Richard III. This was the play that filled him with dread. He could not escape the fear that he might fail. His friend and fellow actor John Mills was coming to the first night. He came to the dressing room before the performance, where Olivier blurted out, I just want you to know you are going to see a bloody awful performance. It's a dreadful production, and I was an idiot to let them persuade me to play this bloody part. There followed what Mills described as the most majestic and inspired performance I have ever seen. Noel Coward raved, I think this is the greatest male performance I have ever seen in the theatre. The accolades poured in. Robert Stevens, a supporting member of the cast, believes that Olivier had not decided how to play the part until the very last minute. It was only when his first entrance provoked a roar of laughter because of his exaggeratedly grotesque appearance that he realised it must be played as a comedy. But although his performance raised many laughs, they were uneasy laughs. It was his achievement to be at the same time ridiculous and infinitely menacing. Never for an instant did the audience doubt that it was in the presence of unadulterated evil. His death lingers in the mind, writhing like a demented spider, arms and legs shooting out in fearful convulsions, seeking to bring down his enemies, even though himself doomed. He performed what critic Harold Hobson called a horizontal dance. As if it were not enough to have completed the film of Henry V and triumphed in Richard III, Olivier now took on his first serious work as a stage director. He was looking for a play for himself and Vivian Leigh, and chose Thornton Wilder's The Skin of Our Teeth. It opened in May 1945. Again, it had a rapturous reception, and Leigh in particular was acclaimed for her performance. Best of all, Thornton Wilder came to see it. "I never knew I'd written such a play," he said in awe. It had already been a year of miracles for Olivier. There was more to come. The Old Vic embarked on the second phase of its triumphant progress, with success after success, from the two parts of Henry IV to Oedipus to Sheridan's The Critic, and to crown the season, Olivier took on the role of Lear, directing it as well as playing the king. Olivier the director did no favours for Olivier the actor. If the needs of the play demanded that Olivier the actor should be reined in, then Olivier the director would make sure it was done. He was harsh on himself and on others. Marion Spencer, who had been the original choice for Regan, was summarily sacked. "I found very soon that the part did not suit you," wrote Olivier. "Nor were you sympathetic to my view of the part, and I really did not think it right to attempt to force my view on an actress of your standing and knowledge." So out she went, a dire warning to other cast members that if they crossed the director, they would be likely to regret it. By the end of its first season, in April 1946, the Old Vic had achieved the sort of cult status we now associate with pop stars. On its last night, 2,500 delirious fans massed outside the theatre, cheering any actors who showed their faces and setting up a wild chant of "We want Larry." The Old Vic Company had produced some of the finest performances that had ever graced the London, or indeed any other, stage. For this, credit above all must be given to Richardson and Olivier. They complemented each other to perfection, although inevitably there was tension and a sense of rivalry. When Richardson was given a knighthood in 1947, Olivier wrote in his memoirs, "You should have heard my screams of fury." What should come next? Although the Old Vic gave great professional satisfaction, it did not provide enough in the way of income. Avoiding the advent of television, Olivier opted to return to film, to produce, direct, and star in Hamlet. It was to rank with Henry V as the most important, if not the most successful, film he had ever made. After this triumph, Rank would have let Olivier make any film he wanted. But what did he want? The Old Vic was awaiting his return, but would not another season there be repeating what he had done before? He had acted recently on Broadway and felt no immediate wish to return to Hollywood. He decided to take a theatre company to Australasia, creating a second company for the Old Vic, as part of his firm belief that they should have one permanently on tour. Knighted just before he sailed, he suspected he had been honoured so that the Australians would not feel short-changed by having a mere Mr. and Mrs. Olivier in their midst. Whatever the explanation, at least it meant he had caught up with Richardson. On July the 15th, 1948, while performing in Perth, Olivier received a letter from the chairman of the Old Vic, Lord Esher, thanking him for all he had done to build up the company, but saying that the board felt in future it should not be run by actors but by some full-time administrator who could devote himself exclusively to the work. His and Richardson's contracts would not be renewed. Nothing had prepared Olivier for this terse dismissal. To be eased out gently might have been acceptable, but to be notified in a brief and not in the least apologetic letter when he was at the other end of the earth and engaged in Old Vic business was intolerable. For the moment, he decided there was little to do except stay quiet and finish the tour. Lord Esher felt the Old Vic had become too dependent on its two stars. The spirit of repertory was being eroded, and the finances were shaky. He was not alone in this. Barbara Ward, one of the most influential board members, firmly believed that the director of a putative national theatre should never be an actor. Meanwhile, on the tour, Vivian Leigh was under great strain, and growing increasingly unpredictable. My birth sign is Scorpio, and they eat themselves up and burn themselves out, she told a reporter. She spoke lightly, but she must have believed there was truth in it. The tuberculosis she had in 1945 was only part of her health problem. It became ever more clear that things were likely to get a great deal worse. Back in London at the end of 1948, Olivier confronted Lord Isher, who surprised him by offering him sole stewardship of the company. Olivier answered that he could not betray his friend Richardson, who had been effectively sacked, in such a way. But Isher was referring to the future, to a time, he hoped only 2 or 3 years away, when the Old Vic would be reborn as the National Theatre, and a fresh start would be needed. Olivier resolved to work out the end of his contract and shake the dust of the Old Vic from his feet. It remained only for him to leave the place as gracefully as possible. His farewell speech contrived to say nothing critical of the board, while leaving a strong impression he had been misused. Isher, for his part, wrote an effusive letter to record the governor's sense of loss and to express his confident hope that time would bring us together again. If he meant himself as an individual, Olivier would have had as little as possible to do with him. If he meant the Old Vic transformed into the National Theatre, then time would indeed bring them together in the not-too-distant future. The Oliviers' marriage wore inexorably more thin. In the first fury of their passions, they had been prepared to make serious sacrifices for each other. When the relationship subsided into the humdrum, they grew to resent the demands of marriage. Vivien Leigh became slightly bored with him. He grew irritated by what he saw as her affectations. They were falling out of love. No two people of their skills, ambitions, and restless temperaments would have found it easy to share a life. If Olivier's version of events is to be accepted, one day when they were sitting on the porch at their cottage, Leigh almost casually remarked, "I don't love you anymore." "I felt as if I had been condemned to death," Olivier wrote. "The central force of my life, my heart, in fact, had been removed." He was never one to underplay his emotions. She was not in love with anyone else, Leigh explained, but she now looked on him as a brother. "Somewhat to my surprise," Olivier commented dryly, "occasional acts of incest were not discouraged." The marriage limped on until 1951, and it was at this point that Leigh's mental illness, which we now know as bipolar disorder, took over her life. In a brief period of seeming stability, Leigh accepted a role that would involve filming in what was then called Ceylon. Olivier turned down the offer to co-star, and Leigh embarked on an affair with her leading man, Peter Finch. A few weeks into filming, she had a severe breakdown, and he was summoned urgently to the set. "When she spoke to me, it was in that tone of halting, dreamlike amazement that people in the theatre use for mad scenes." He managed to get his wife sedated, onto an airplane home, and into a nursing home to recover. It would be the best part of 10 years before the Oliviers finally divorced. During this period, they appeared in public together, acted together, notably in Antony and Cleopatra in London and on Broadway, and most of the time they cohabited in imperfect harmony. But the marriage, in its full sense, was over. After her breakdown, Olivier remembers, she was an entirely different person. I never really knew her again.
Toby Jones was reading extracts from Olivier by Philip Ziegler. The book is abridged and directed by Eileen Horn, produced by Clive Brill, and is a Pacificus production for BBC Radio 4. We're fading up in the background, a hint of what is to come as we go sailing by on the ebb tide to the shipping forecast. now with the time at 12 minutes to 1, the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 on Friday the 8th of November. There are warnings of gales in Forties, Cromarty, Forth, Rockall, Malin, Hebrides, Bailey, Fair Isle, Faroes and South East Iceland. The general synopsis at 1800, low Bailey 977, expected 180 miles north of Viking 981 by 1800 today. The area forecasts for the next 24 hours, Viking north at Cira. Southwesterly 5 to 7, perhaps gale 8 later in Viking. Showers good. South at Cira, 40s, Cromarty, Forth, Tyne, Dogger. Southwesterly 5 to 7, occasionally gale 8 at first in 40s, Cromarty and Forth. Veering westerly or northwesterly 4 or 5 later, except Cromarty.